So can we go ahead and give Dina Veltre, who used to come to our Valley Group meetings on Wednesday nights, a big round of a Valley Group applause.
Thank you. Spirit hands. There we go. Thank you. Okay, I'm unmuted, right? Okay, good, good. I am not Zoom savvy. Well, thank you very, very much, Tammy, my dear friend who invited me to speak this evening and allow me to, you know, reconnect with people who who made an important impact on my life and in my sobriety. You know, Bill was the very first person I met when I moved to Visalia. I was jonesing for a meeting, and he was out front. And you know, Jim has been great. I've seen him at many meetings. That's awesome. Justin, I've met. And Sonia, it was so nice to see you too. I really, really am happy to see your face. So, one of my best buds from Phoenix, Julie's with me this evening, and visiting from Iowa via virtually. So it's nice to have some familiar faces. You know, sometimes it's like, oh, I'm going to speak. I don't want anybody to hear it. You know, but today I'm happy to have people that I know and familiar faces in the audience, so to speak. One day and 28 years. That one day looks a lot different than it did that first one day. And I am, you know, grateful can't be overused in this program. You know, I have a selfish bone, so when I'm able to say that I'm grateful and mean it, it's a good thing. It's a good thing because I still have to work at being grateful, you know. I do. But I am grateful for that. I am grateful that this program exists. I had no idea what Alcoholics Anonymous was. I wasn't introduced at any level growing up. As Jim mentioned, I grew up in middle class, you know, Redondo Beach, and had a good, loving family. But I felt like a misfit. My mother was older when she had me. She was like 45, so there was a bigger generation gap back then than the women who have children later in life nowadays. It just was a different gig, and I felt like the odd man out. I thought I was adopted. It was just very strange, and and my family was loving but very stern, I guess is the good word. I mean, I guess we can say it was, it was stern and you know, follow the rules and you know, do as you're told or get hit. You know, they call it abuse nowadays. Back then it was discipline. I'll let you guys work that one out within your own heart. I know that I'm an alcoholic. I am not limited to that label, however. I've also learned through Alcoholics Anonymous that I'm not limited to that label. I am a child of a power greater than myself that gives me the ability to recover, renew, rejoice, get out of myself, reach out, just have a life. And I wouldn't have learned that anywhere else, I don't think, except for Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been through therapy, I've been in the hospital, I've tried to live on my laurels, I've not succeeded very long in those areas, in using that kind of approach. The steps outlined in Alcoholics Anonymous and the people who share their experience, strength, and hope is what's allowed me to be vulnerable and learn. My first drink was a drug. It was easier to get. It was just easier to get. My parents did not overdrink. They did not have a, you know, a nice little setup with their whiskey or whatever it was with the glasses. We didn't operate like that. So if I wanted to steal a drink or a sip of a beer, you know, I had to be really good at it. It was just too much work. I could go down the street and I could get pretty much whatever I wanted, but except for alcohol, you know, it was just a different way that I grew up in. So my first drug was pot. It was after a violent experience in my home. And, you know, I did not know what to do. I knew I couldn't live in the situation I was in. I knew I was too young to leave. And I knew that I wasn't going to get by just taking it. I wasn't going to make it. I had a lot of resentment. I had a lot of fear. I had a lot of misgivings and untrusted, untrustworthy. I didn't trust people. And it was, or actually the other way around, I trusted people too much, and I still do. I trust people a little bit too much, and I usually end up with, you know, a kick in the teeth. But that's okay. You know, I've learned a little bit more. So when I got high the first time, I had that overall sense of relief that they talk about in the book with regard to alcohol. And so as soon as I could, I started to try and get alcohol and more drugs and, you know, try and manipulate and you know, dodge and weave and make myself available in unsavory places to get them. You know, I disrespected myself and, made poor choices, but I was making poor choices with the mindset of a person, of a child under the influence in a victim mentality. I don't think too many people in that kind of position make good choices. You're just trying to get by, you're trying to live, you're trying to survive, you're trying to get where you need to get and live somehow. You know that it's available, you know a better life's available, but you're just not quite sure how to get that far. Like I said, my mother and father were loving, but they were reactive to things. And I was I say this for those who have experienced this, have had an experience like this, so that you know you can heal. I am a healed survivor of sexual abuse. My parents reacted to that in a way that kept me pretty well tied down. They just didn't let me go and do too much. So I was always trying to break free. You know, I'm always trying to break free. I'm very, to this day, I'm question authority. I don't like following the rules. If I can find a shortcut or a back door, I'm using it. It's just the way that I learned to deal with those sort of things. As I got through high school and stuff, it was a lot easier to drink. It was a lot easier to fit in when I was under the influence. I drank whatever was available, whatever was offered, whatever I could, you know, manipulate out of your hands. So that was just the way I operated, because there was so much emotion, unchanneled, unreleased emotion that I couldn't, didn't know what to do with. I played sports that helped, but it didn't relieve it. And I operated like that for a long time. I graduated from school, but I wasn't encouraged to go to college, so I didn't. I went to work. I did my best to do well in those areas, to have someone be proud of me and to tell me I did well. But I wasn't. What I really wanted was to be acknowledged for what I did know. Convince you that I knew everything. And get paid, you know. I wanted the dough. I wanted the money. And I figured that was my only way out of my situation. So I did what I did. I'm not proud of those situations, but like I said, it was more of a self-disrespecting in behaviors than it was, you know, ripping people off or anything like that. I didn't do anything like that. I met my daughter's father when I was 19, and we moved in together right away, and we played house, and he introduced me to a harder, more addictive level of drugs. But we were making money because we could sell it now. So I became fairly decent at moving drugs, and you know, alcohol was the primer. Alcohol got me loose enough to be able to discern the room or the bar, figure out, you know, who's looking and who needs it and how to, you know, just kind of character assassinate without any like skills. So we got in a lot of trouble. You know, I call my 20s the terrible twos of my adult life. I had tantrums, you know, I threw things, I pouted, I manipulated, I made deals, I threw him out, you know, I ran out, you know, I mean, just terrible behavior, but very appropriate for a person who hadn't grown any older than 15 with a victim mentality. So it became, you're not going to get away with what you're going to get away with. I will have my revenge, my vindictiveness. I will have the last word at some point. So, you know, it became a very contentious and difficult environment to live in. When I was 24, my mother passed away suddenly, and when I was 26, my father passed away suddenly. And at that point, I didn't know that at the time, but when it wasn't until I got sober that I learned these words and these terms, I was very codependent upon them. I couldn't do anything without them, but they were so incredibly critical. I couldn't live by myself. I required their input on everything. So when they died suddenly, I was pretty much hanging by a thread, counting on other people who were never really. I had pushed a lot of people away by then. I had caused a lot of damage, a lot of personal relationships damaged. I love in step four, the agnostics, you know, these personal relationships. We couldn't have one. We didn't know how to have one. There was constant difficulty or you know, inadequacies, and I think back and I get the shivers, like, oh God, no wonder I was so difficult. I'm glad to say that Alcoholics Anonymous saved me from making it any worse. At about 27, I ended up in jail. You think it would be an opportunity to straighten out, you know, but it wasn't. I considered it a vacation. I was sleeping on a steel bed. with a, you know, 2-inch mattress, and they threw in a junkie, and they were trying to get me to talk, you know, just so you know, everything has a camera and every place has a microphone, just FYI, especially jail. So, you know, I didn't budge on that, and the girl was really suffering, and I couldn't even have the compassion enough to help her or, you know, talk to her. I said, just leave me alone. And I stayed in that jail cell until I could figure out a solution to get out. And I found a solution about a week later, 2 weeks later. I don't remember too much, but I got out and Pepsi fine and everything. And I didn't even think about straightening up. I got out and got high right away. I was like, the drama, you know, it was like, oh my God, I went to jail. I got caught, you know, and that got fixed. And but the marriage started to get really ugly by then. And although I had my daughter, I had my daughter. Actually, I missed a spot. I think I went to jail at 26. I had my daughter at 27. So it was right after that, and thinking maybe that would fix me, you know, that external solution, still seeking external relief. It didn't. At 32, I got a divorce, and I was pretty much struggling with a toddler, and didn't know. I was working, I was functional, but I was miserable. There wasn't one thing in my life that really gave me joy, because raising a 3-year-old by yourself is work. That's not all that fun. And it was a lot of work. And I decided to go to therapy. So I went to therapy, and the gal asked me the 20 questions, and never heard of them before or anything like that. And she goes, did you ever consider yourself an addict or an alcoholic? I go, what? Fuck no. You know, excuse me. But anyway, yeah, no. No. And she goes, well, are you open? Would you consider Al-Anon? What is it? So she hooked me up, and so I went to Al-Anon in Compton. And Compton is Compton. And I sat between two very bold women, very bold, beautiful spirit women, but that's not what I thought they were at the time. I was scared to death of them, you know. And they just sat there and told me to sit down, shut up, and listen. And I found out within about 30 days that I belonged across the hall in Alcoholics Anonymous, or CA, or MA, or any other of the others. I could have qualified in any of them. So I tried going to other meetings, and I found myself most directed, most willing in Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, I knew that I was just one more bad experience away from putting a needle in my arm. I sold it and I moved it, but I hadn't used it yet. Yet. And so, you know, it was time to go. It was time to grow up. You know, my daughter was 3. I'm still operating in fear, and I needed help. And I started to go to AA meetings in Westminster and Santa Monica and Culver City and Compton and Long Beach. And, you know, I started to hear the message of hope, the message of recovery, the message of, you know, there's a power greater than yourself, Dina, that may help you. Because I didn't even know what my problem was. I just knew life was a mess and I was really struggling. And I'm grateful for the old timers of the 90s. They came up to you and told you that they were your sponsor. And they told you to sit down and smoke your cigarette and be quiet. And they told you that you're going to be okay, but they don't want to hear what you've got to share because you're just sharing the mess, not the message. and it was real abrupt and abrasive, but I guess I kind of needed that with, you know, the willingness that God had given me. I don't know where the willingness came from. I really don't. I mean, at the time, I know now that it was God's grace of willingness. So I was able to hear what these people were saying and be willing to try. So I gave it a try. And I thought that, okay, I can learn to drink. And, you know, I was ready to give up the drugs, but I said, you know, I don't want to give up drinking. You know, I'm no. And I did the steps to the best of my ability. I held back on the 4. I didn't finish the 9th. And after a year, after I picked up my chip for the first year, I went and celebrated down in Mexico on the booze cruise, and I got drunk. I got real drunk. I got really, really hammered. I was drinking tequila out of a high-powered water gun. And they poured me off that boat and into my room, and it was lucky I didn't get hurt again. And because I went by myself, I'm pretty self-reliant, and I just felt like Alcoholics Anonymous wasn't for me either. I felt that misfit, right? I just felt like something was in the way, and I couldn't pray. But when I got back, I called my sponsor, and she goes, "How are you doing? Did you have a good time?" I go, "Yeah, I had a great time." She goes, "Did you drink?" As if she knew. I mean, there's no way anybody knew I drank. No way. And I went, "Yes." And she goes, "What?" And so she had me come over to her house, and she said point blank, "Either you're willing to go to any length and believe that there's a power greater than yourself, and recognize that you're unmanageable and that you cannot do this on your own, or you will die." People have threatened me like that in real dramatic ways, but I never really took it. And this woman wasn't anything that I would have expected to talk to me like this, but I guess I just heard her. Like I said, I think God's grace of willingness just opened that door just that little bit. Say, okay, what do I got to do? So we started again. And about 6 weeks later, I stood up to as a newcomer again. So, you know, this is a difficult program. It's hard, you know. But I think life is hard, and it's the program that helps us understand how to do life. Because, I mean, I don't know how I have 28 years other than showing up, suiting up, being of service. I mean, those first couple, four years, I was in service every day, in meetings every day. My daughter spent a lot of time at babysitters. That's when you could take children to meetings at times, and people watched her, and, you know, so she grew up in the rooms, and I met a man who was kind and smart and willing to, you know, I want to say 13 step, but he did it in a way that was legitimate. It was for our benefit to be a sober couple, to understand how to live together in sobriety. So I believed in that. But then I got scared again. And he wanted to move, and I didn't. So I stayed in California, and I started to get really alone and scared and unsure of myself again. And that sponsor was no longer available to me, and my new sponsor was, but she had already stepped on my toes a little bit too hard. And, you know, I was like, I don't want to call her, you know. And, you know, the ego gets involved. My ego got involved. And I couldn't take direction anymore. So I how do you say it? I just kind of gave up, and I asked for help from the man that I met, and he offered to marry me, and I thought that would be a good idea because he would also be a good provider for my daughter. And that's hard to say out loud still. I mean, I've had to have that conversation with him as well. But we moved to Arizona, and we raised our daughter for 15 years, and then we broke apart. And it was kind of by the same thing, you know. I got scared. Things weren't going the way I wanted them to go. And you know, to tie it off a little bit here, or kind of close a little bit, is I couldn't grow as a person without the steps. I needed someone to help me go through the steps. So when I moved to Arizona, I waited 6 months. I mean, I'm going to meetings, but I'm not shaking anybody's hand. I've got 4 years. I'm not shaking anybody's hand. I'm not saying I'm new here. I'm still kind of tight, wrapped up like barbed wire, just tight. And not able to relax and know that, you know, be still and know God is there, and couldn't rely on the steps. I was kind of flailing, and I remember telling myself, I'm going to go to this meeting, and if I don't find a sponsor here, I'm going to go to the bar that's next door to the meeting and drink, because I can't live with, what is it, a head full of AA and no booze and all that fear and all that agitation. I needed relief, and I wasn't working the steps, so I needed relief. And like, again, God, you know, Julie was speaking that night with her husband, and I heard what she said, and she said that, you know, you have to have the willingness to go to any length to do what you have to do. You know, I almost died on an operating table, you know, on an OD table, you know. And she shared her story of that was a lot harder than mine. And I just thought, God, you know, I need that confidence. I need that determination to know that I can make it. She had a God that she was sharing with everyone from the podium. And I asked her to be my sponsor that evening. And we have been attached to the hip, I think, since then. And, you know, I am so grateful and so happy that God put her in my life, that we can walk this journey together, because it's not easy. I need someone's hand to hold. I do. And sometimes I can call her, and sometimes she's not the gal to call. You know, sometimes we're sick on the same day, you know. I have to be an active participant in my sobriety, working the steps, reading the book, being of service, you know, and it comes and it goes and it's waves and it's in and out, and, you know, there's expectations that still come out, you know, but we work through them, you know, we work through them. We work the steps to maintain a friendship. We work the steps to live life on life's terms. We work the steps to hold each other up, encourage each other. You know, I get that from a lot of people that I've mentioned earlier that I know in this meeting. And I'm grateful, and I want you to know that I would do the same for you. All you have to do is call me. Can't read your mind. You got to call, and you got to pick up that 500-pound phone and ask for help. And I think what's cool about Alcoholics Anonymous is that you can be vulnerable and not be shamed. That is such a gift of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't live in shame anymore. I live knowing that the peace of God is available to me. I live knowing that God can lift me up when I'm down at the bottom, and I know that I can ask somebody to pray for me or show me how to reconnect with God when I've lost the connection, because that's happened too. You know, I still like we agnostics in chapter 4 and step 2, where, you know, it came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I mean, I've been in and out of the steps this whole journey. You know, there's always a step that I could be doing that I do. You know, I could do a fourth on a napkin at lunch. You know, it's not complicated. It's scary. And I know that I can come to Alcoholics Anonymous to help me find the courage to move forward through it. But with step 2, you know, that insanity, I hated being told I was insane. I just had the wrong definition. You know, and as I can walk through this journey now, I still have insane behavior, you know, doing the same thing, expecting different results, making the same phone call, you know, trying to make some kind of vendor do what they're not going to do, you know, at work or whatever. You know, I'm still trying to manipulate and control, and all I need to do all I need to do is ask God to help me, you know, understand why I need that, why I think I need that, because it's not true. It's a belief that's not true, and it's causing me conflict. It's causing me hurt. It's causing me pain. And what I found, like, right lately, is that nothing's worth my serenity. So even though life is very upside down, everybody's going through it now. I mean, there was a time when I think most alcoholics thought that they were the only ones, you know. Now you know we're not. Now you know that the world is complex and scary and difficult on a level for everyone. And we're the lucky ones to have an opportunity to use an actual guideline, an actual steps to iron out where our fear is, where our growth is, where our correction is, because it's not with you. I hate sometimes I hate the shortcomings of my coworkers. I hate the rudeness of some people I have to talk to in customer service where they're not customer service at all, you know. But that's life, you know. They have a right to be human and have bad days too. They have a right to be irresponsible. They have a right to not have integrity. They have a right to be just off the rocker. Hard to understand and difficult. But it's my responsibility to ask my higher power for direction and how to handle it. I told Jim earlier today, you know, if I could be proud of myself for 28 years, I'm proud of myself for 28 years, because all I did was just put faith in a program that I knew nothing about and watched other people do their damnedest to try and make it and not put a drink in their mouth or a drug in their system and just try and make it and become the person that they really knew that they wanted to be. And I thought, I'm going to try and do the same. And I wasn't given that gift outside of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was given it inside by participating in my own recovery. I could give you plenty of experiences that could tell you, hey, don't go back to a meeting. It's like living in a fishbowl. I can give you plenty of experiences like that. I've had disappointments and hurts within the program. Oh, well. It's not going to take. It's not enough for me to blow my sobriety or the joy that I've been given being sober. I have a good life. I want more, and I feel like I have an opportunity to make that happen if I stay sober, and do my best. It's not going to be perfect, but I can do my best. So with that, I'm going to end. I hope that gave you just a glimpse of where I've been. You know, it's really hard to cram 28 years into 45 minutes, but I'm happy to be here. I'm happy to have friendships in this program, and God bless you all. So with that, I'll pass. Thanks.
Thanks so much.
I just want to say thank you.
Thanks.
Good job.